Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director of the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. Congress seemingly won't have to deal with a rescissions package from the Trump administration that would have clawed back about $4 billion in unspent foreign aid. The president decided against the proposal, which could have made the fiscal year 2020 appropriations process, that is still ongoing, even more politically complicated. It also could have sparked a legal challenge over whether such a request violated the 1974 Budget Act. Several Republican and Democratic leaders were against the rescissions package being discussed. The Congressional Budget Office is now projecting trillion-dollar deficits as early as the upcoming fiscal year, which is 2 years earlier than its previous forecast. The primary catalyst is the recent budget deal that eliminated previously existing spending caps and set new spending levels that are expected to add $1.7 trillion to deficits over the next 10 years. CBO expects real GDP to grow a little faster because of the added spending, but it is projected to be outweighed by the cost of the ongoing trade war. We'll talk more about CBO's report in an upcoming segment. The Trump administration no longer seems likely to advocate for a new round of tax cuts at this time, but they may be back on the table as the president engages in his campaign for re-election. The latest round of tax cuts reportedly being considered by the president would have been a cut to payroll and capital gains taxes, but the president quickly reversed course, saying such cuts were not needed because of a strong economy. New tax cuts would likely be a tough sell in Congress with a divided House and Senate, but it could be a popular campaign talking point for the president. Up next, I'll be joined by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby to discuss an updated budget outlook report by the CBO and get an update on what's happening in Washington. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. Bob is a regular contributor on the program. Welcome back to Facing the Future.
Great to be back, Chase.
Always a pleasure to talk to my boss, but I think we've got some really important subjects to discuss today. And I want to kick off the top of the program with an updated report by the Congressional Budget Office. They call it an update to the budget and economic outlook from 2019 to 2029, so a 10-year budget window. Can you give just a quick synopsis for our listeners what that report is meant to do and maybe some of the high watermark numbers and figures that came out of it?
Sure. Well, the CBO produces every year a baseline, which is just looking at spending and taxes and where it will all come out over 10 years. On a year-by-year basis under current law. And so what they put out last week was an update to their baseline. It was pretty significant because it incorporated the effect of the budget deal that Congress and the president reached earlier this month. You know, there was a big fight about, you know, reaching a budget deal on appropriations and the debt limit. And so what happened was Congress and the president decided to raise spending caps that were in place for the next 2 years. And then they didn't impose any new spending caps after that. And they suspended the debt limit for another 2 years. So CBO looked at all of that and plugged that into their baseline, and where it came out was basically it increased deficit projections over the next 10 years by close to $1 trillion, because the new budget deal raised the level of appropriations very significantly by about $1.7 trillion over the next 10 years. Now, that doesn't mean that Congress has already approved all of that money. This is just a projection of where appropriations would be if they take the 2 years that they have agreed to and extended that, adjusting for inflation every year. So that's an assumption that the CBO makes.
And Bob, are there any other factors? We leaned in pretty heavily on the recent budget deal as being a reason for a significant change between the January baseline and the update this month. Are there any other factors that come into play here?
Yeah, they also adjust their economic projections and their assumptions about interest costs, because interest costs are very important. And when you're racking up, particularly when you're racking up a lot of new debt, you want to look at the interest costs. The interesting thing about this report was that CBO pretty significantly ratcheted downward its projection of interest rates that the federal government has to pay and on money that it borrows. And that ratcheted down significantly the interest cost assumption. So that, you know, while the legislation added significantly to the debt, to the deficits over the next 10 years, that is partially but not completely offset by an assumption that the government will be paying less in interest, not because it's taking on less debt, but because there's a pretty significantly lower assumption about interest costs.
How does this update compare to the alternative, one of the alternative scenarios in CBO's original baseline projections? I know we've talked about in the past on the show how it seems that some of these alternative scenarios presented by CBO, which follow more closely policy trends versus existing law, are at times more realistic. Is this a step toward really alignment with one of those alternative scenarios, or is this on its own?
It probably falls somewhere in between the two long-term scenarios that CBO put out in June. One of them assumed that the caps would hold and that the tax cuts that are scheduled to expire after 2025 would actually expire. And if you look at those two assumptions, you bring in more revenue and you're not spending as much. What happened here was that Congress and the administration already raised the caps, and the new baseline is pretty close to that assumption that CBO made earlier in their so-called alternative baseline, which was a scenario in which Congress spent more and taxed less. So you got a bigger debt under that alternative. We're probably a little bit closer now to that alternative baseline because Congress already agreed to the higher spending and may yet agree to the lower taxes. There are a lot of tax cut proposals on the table. But I want to stress again that the big difference that mitigates some of that increase in projected debt from the alternative baseline is that the change in interest assumptions.
So let's piggyback off of that for a second. Can you share at all how much of a decrease there was in projected interest costs? Because if I remember correctly, for a while, a lot of organizations and individuals have been talking about how the quick growth of interest costs in the budget was going to crowd out other areas. Is that still the case, or are we looking at something that's going to flatline around a certain figure and there are now other issues to worry about?
Well, it's not going to flatline. This is actually an interesting point about how deep the budget hole is and what trouble we're in fiscally is that even with CBO trimmed their interest cost assumption by a little over $1 trillion over 10 years. I mean, that's a pretty good chunk of money. To give you an example, in the 10th year out, we were projecting, CBO was projecting, that interest costs would be over $900 billion a year by 2029. They're now saying it's about $800 billion a year by 2029.
That's still a big chunk.
Yeah. But it still is a problem because we've got so much debt that even with a pretty low interest rate on that debt, you're still talking about debt rising as a percentage of the budget, debt rising as a percentage of GDP. $800 billion, you know, within 10 years, it's a lot of money. We're up over $300 billion now, almost $400 billion. So, you know, the good news is the government gets a break, if these low interest rates continue. But the bad news is that that doesn't come anywhere near to solving our problems. Interest is still a growing part of the budget and still, you know, to a certain extent is going to be crowding out other things.
Did the downshift in interest cost come as a surprise to CBO, or is this just something that they hadn't made an adjustment to yet and they're finally doing so? Because it seems like, you know, we've had very low interest rates for a while, artificially low, many would say. So why all of a sudden this big shift downward?
Well, I think that they've been gradually shifting downward their assumptions about interest costs for a long time. It's just that interest costs keep coming in, interest rates keep surprising on the downside. And so when they do their updates, they might hold back for a little while, but then they'll throw in the towel and say, okay, we believe it. The interest rates are going to stay lower for a while. So this was a, you know, fairly significant shift downward, but they've made other shifts.
I want to step back and go to something you were talking about a little bit earlier, and that is the budget deficit. And if I remember correctly, the report also sort of put a fast forward on how quickly trillion-dollar deficits are going to arrive. Can you break that down a little bit for us?
Yeah, I mean, the downward number on interest doesn't save us from the bigger picture. Here is that the deficit situation is worse in this update because of things that Congress and the president have done. It's legislative actions that are driving the deficit bigger. And so because of the budget deal that they enacted, which raised spending, the CBO is now projecting that we'll hit a $1 trillion deficit in the next fiscal year, 2020. And that moved up by a couple of years. And we're going to come close to it this year in the high 900s. Watch this space around September 30th. And we'll see, and sometime in early October, we'll get an idea of whether or not we hit $1 trillion this year. But even if we don't, it seems like that we're probably going to hit a $1 trillion deficit next year.
Are we still looking at sustained $1 trillion deficits or even beyond that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is not a any sort of, you hit a peak and you start going down. The budget deficit continues to rise in every year, which is what makes this whole problem unsustainable. I mean, it's this budget outlook is worse than the January budget outlook because of what they did with the budget deal.
And CBO has a tendency to add up or give you the total figure for budget deficits over that 10-year window. And in years past, it's been, you know, $9 trillion, $10 trillion. What are they saying the next 10 years of total deficits could look like?
Well, $12.2 trillion.
Wow.
it's getting up there. And by 2029, 10 years out, the annual deficit they're projecting is $1.4 trillion.
And that was the peak we saw in the Great Recession, correct? Like that would match our all-time high in terms of a nominal figure.
Yeah, pretty close. It might be higher. I forget exactly what the peak was. I think it was around $1.2 trillion, but it might have been higher. But at any rate, the significance is that debt and deficits are going up as a percentage of the economy, certainly in dollar terms, but more significantly as a percentage of the economy. They're doing this because that's what current policy has baked into the cake. And that's the definition of a unsustainable policy. And we're doing this for no particular reason other than we feel like it. These are the laws that have been enacted. It's not because of wars. It's not because of recession. You know, you think of high deficits in the past, like you referenced the last time that the deficits were over $1 trillion. It was because of the recession. And so right now, the significant thing about this is that we're increasing deficits, increasing debt at a time of relative peace and prosperity, which is really unprecedented in our history.
You made a good point with the percentage of the economy or percentage of GDP with these figures. And that's something that we as the Concord Coalition will typically lean in on, because it's not really, I mean, we're talking significant dollars, but we're also talking about a pretty large economy that has a tendency to grow as well. What did CBO put out there in terms of where the budget deficit is as a percentage of the economy going into next year and 10 years out? And you know, how does that compare to our historic average or what should be a more comfortable ratio?
Well, the 50-year average for deficits is 2.9% of GDP. And what we're expecting this year is 4.5% of GDP. So that's a pretty significant increase. And over the next 10 years, the average deficit would be 4.7% of GDP. So that's that's why the debt rises as a percentage of GDP, because the economy is not growing that fast. And so the debt is rising faster than the economy. The deficits, this sort of sustained deficit above 4% is unprecedented, and it's keep going up.
Where does it put us as a percentage of the economy with the publicly held debt, the national debt? So the total of all these figures, I know we're around 78% of the economy right now. Where does CBO see us going?
95% of GDP within 10 years. And that still assumes, by the way, that a lot of tax cuts that are scheduled to expire are actually going to expire. And I've got some real doubts about that. Once tax cuts are enacted, it's hard for Congress to let them go. So if they extended some of these tax provisions or added new ones, you could easily reach 100% of GDP within 10 years.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord Coalition's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. We're discussing an update to the Congressional Budget Office's baseline or 10-year budget outlook, and it's looking a little grim, even though we've had a bit of an offset with interest costs from the debt. There are new spending initiatives and tax cuts that are putting our figures back into an accelerated climb, even seeing $1 trillion deficits arrive as early as the upcoming fiscal year. And one of the other things the CBO dove into in this report, Bob, if I'm remembering correctly, is projections for economic growth. And this might get to, oftentimes when we talk about these issues from a Concord Coalition perspective, we talk about the comfort level in terms of deficits to the size of the economy, the historic average. And if you're floating around that 2-3% of deficit to GDP, you're probably not growing the debt too rapidly, or it might be somewhat stable, but that requires economic growth to keep pace with that. So what does CBO see in terms of economic growth, either the next couple of years or the next 10 to 20?
Well, there's not a whole lot of good news there either. If one is hoping for a fast economy to help us grow our way out of the deficit and debt problem, it's not in the cards. They're going to have to change policies to try to do something about economic growth. But, CBO is projecting, we've got growth right now that's around 2.5% adjusted for inflation, annual growth. We used to be more used to 3% growth. CBO in the next 10 years and beyond is projecting average growth of less than 2%, 1.8% to be precise. And that is a, you know, that would have been considered pretty anemic growth years ago. It still is. It's not the sort of growth that you're going to grow your way out of massive deficits. And the reason for that, you know, there are several reasons, but one is the simply the aging population, the fact that there are a lot of workers leaving the workforce. And so we have a slower growing workforce. And part of it is a slowdown in productivity. And deficits, quite frankly, can, over the long run, can have a harmful effect on the economy because they limit investment, which limits productivity, and it's kind of a long chain of events. But more of the borrowing that the federal government does goes to current consumption rather than to reinvesting in the economy. So for a number of reasons, our projected economic growth is, you know, pretty significantly slower than it has been in past decades.
And I want to get to some other topics here, but I'm also curious about a couple more things with this report. One is, we talk a lot about, again, from the Concord Coalition perspective, mandatory spending programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, being pretty significant drivers in spending and in many ways growth of the deficit. Did CBO put out anything particularly revealing with regard to trends in those programs in the next 10 years, or is it pretty much what you would expect at this point?
They didn't make any significant changes in that. I mean, the storyline there is the same, which is that programs like the ones you mentioned are the ones that are growing faster than the economy. And even with this budget deal, the budget deal raised discretionary spending, the annual appropriations bills, but that's 30% of the budget, and the mandatory spending is like 60%, a little over 60%, with the rest interest on the debt. So the new update basically confirmed that storyline, which is that it's the mandatory spending that is growing the spending part of the budget, and so if you look at the future, it's, and try to think about what we need to do to bring about a sustainable budget, it's still, we need to look at the mandatory programs and revenues, which are projected to be lower than has traditionally been the case for the next few years.
One thing we've talked about that from a perspective of reform is in taking advantage of, I guess, what I would consider, or you might even consider, is a honeymoon period with economic growth being on a pretty constant, steady pace, with interest rates remaining pretty low, it being an opportunity to engage in significant reform to put us on a better fiscal path, or at least a better fiscal trajectory. Are we losing that window right now with some of these numbers, or do you think there's still a chance that elected leaders could act soon or act quickly and get us on a new path with relative ease?
I wouldn't bet the farm on that. It doesn't look like anybody is really out to come up with a fiscal sustainability plan. This is really like there's a forest fire or something in the background, and people are running around, you know, sort of having a conversation about something else, ignoring, you know, what's raging on behind them. So there are a lot of proposals for major new spending increases. There are proposals for cutting taxes further. And I'm just not hearing on either side of the political aisle anybody talking about the consequences of the deficits that we already have and the projected debt and the actual debt that we already have. So the idea of coming together on a deficit reduction plan anytime soon is just not in the cards. Obviously, we will need to do something at some point, but I think it's probably going to have to happen after the election. The other thing is, you know, we've had a 10-year quote unquote recovery. I mean, that's, you know, the economy has been expanding for 10 years. It's the longest expansion in history. And that's now, you know, you might consider that a wasted opportunity with regard to putting the budget on a sustainable path, because we haven't done it and it's gotten worse. And now there's, you know, people are saying, well, maybe there's going to be a recession. Inevitably, there will be a recession. And I don't know whether one's coming anytime soon, but the economic conditions right now aren't looking like the kind of buoyant conditions you would look at and say, okay, now is the time to really tackle the deficit. So I'm a little bit concerned that an opportunity has been wasted here. Because if we did go into a recession, you really don't at that point want to start cutting spending and raising taxes, because that would make the recession worse.
Bob, you mentioned that no one is really talking about the consequences of these policies in terms of the growing debt and deficit. Can you lay out what you think some of those consequences would be in terms of the result of a lack of action on these issues?
Well, there are a couple, and unfortunately, none of them are dramatic in the sense of, you know, they make a good picture. I mentioned a forest fire or something. You know, you can imagine something like that, but it's not something that budget deficits don't actually bring about forest fires. So you can't take pictures of them and say, this is what's going to happen.
No, but spending in a budget could avoid them.
Yeah, well. So here's the thing. What it is that we're investing less in the future, which means a lower rate of economic growth. And that slower growing economy is going to have to support a growing healthcare and retirement cost of the population. And so where it comes out is a lower standard of living for future generations, which is, and you know, that's the sort of thing that's very hard to picture, to make pictures of. And that's one consequence is just, you know, these lower growth projections that I talked about before are not an accident. We're going to have a slower growing economy if we just keep running very, very large deficits and running up big debts. The other is the opportunity cost, you might say, of, you know, what do you give up as a society because you can't afford it? As you run bigger and bigger deficits, are we going to have not just a less vibrant economy, but a less creative economy? Do you jeopardize the nation's standing in the world because we can't support the kind of robust national defense that we want? Then there are other things that one could come up with that fall into the more drastic side, like an interest spike that would, if for some reason other nations or investors that buy government bonds would demand a higher interest rate because of the concerns about the federal budget and the government's willingness or ability to service the debt. With the amount of debt that we have, that could be raising. If interest costs were to shoot up, if interest rates were to shoot up, interest costs would go through the roof, and then we'd really be in trouble. It's like trying to pay the interest on your credit card bill if you're just making the minimum payments. So people do worry a little bit about that. You know, suppose we do have a recession, you at that point would expect the government to cut taxes and raise spending to help support the economy. That's the right thing to do. That's the economically correct thing to do. But we're starting from a position of weakness, fiscal weakness, which means that all of the things that we would do to try to get ourselves out of the next recession would add to an already high level of debt, meaning you would come out of the next recession with an even bigger debt. And that's really what happened with the last recession. You know, we went into it with about a 40% debt to GDP ratio and came out of it with about a 70% debt to GDP ratio. And now we're growing the debt to GDP ratio, even with a strong economy. So if we have another recession, we are going to have another spike in the debt. And it ratchets up even more, making all of our potential long-term economic prospects even worse. This is we've kind of taken up some of that cushion that we had 10, 20 years ago to confront a new economic emergency or just other emergencies that might come up. I mean, like if there were some sort of major military confrontation, or think of an emergency, Martians land or something. I mean, something that the federal government would have to respond to. We're just in a weaker position with all this debt to respond to anything. We're spiraling downward. It really, the economy's growing and, it's, that's nice, but you just got to keep, we're not paying attention to it. And while we're not paying attention to it, the debt is growing inexorably. As Paul Tsongas used to say, the numbers are relentless, and it's taking away from the opportunities that future generations are going to have.
So it sounds like a piece of advice you might give to our listeners is, the fact that they're listening, they might not need this advice, but the advice I was going to say would be start paying attention and maybe start reaching out to your elected leaders and calling on them to at least start having a realistic or practical conversation about these issues.
Yeah, I think that they should send a link to Facing the Future to all of their...
I don't disagree with that, not at all. I want to pivot real quick, just the last couple minutes here. I want to get a quick update from you on what's going on in Washington. I'm someone who likes to follow what's going on with fiscal and budget policy because I'm weird that way. And I was seeing things out there about the president considering new payroll tax cuts, considering engaging in what's called a rescissions package. And also, I'd like to get an update from you on what's going on with the appropriations process now that we've got an overall budget deal. So what's going on with tax changes and cuts right now, and where's appropriations?
All right. Well, let me take the appropriations first, because that's something that has to happen or the government will shut down on September 30th. Very important to remember about the budget deal that while it raised the caps, they agreed to spend more. They didn't actually pass the 12 appropriations bills. They just set numbers for what they were going to spend. So now, in a very limited time from Labor Day to September 30th, they have to pass 12 appropriation bills to fund the government. And the House has passed 10 bills, and the Senate has passed none because they didn't want to even start until they had an agreement on the total number. So I don't think that's all going to get done in a couple of weeks in September. So there's probably going to be another, you'll hear the term continuing resolution, which is just continuing for a short time, spending at a current level while they work on the funding bills. I doubt that there's going to be a shutdown on September 30th, but they do have to pass those individual spending bills to make good on that overall agreement that they came to in August. So I hope that there's no shutdown, but you never know. I mean, they could end up fighting over the Homeland Security bill again and border wall funding. It's yet to be seen how that's going to play out. On the tax side, there's been a lot of proposals floating around. I think some of them are related to this idea that the economy is slowing, and in order to prevent the economy from going into a recession, maybe we ought to do a little stimulus by cutting taxes. But then the president put that on the table and then took it off the table because part of his other argument is that the economy is doing just great. So if the economy is doing just great, why would you want to take an extraordinary measure like cutting payroll taxes to try to goose the economy? I think that all end up just like, never mind. I mean, I don't think there are any major new tax proposals on the table except things that are always hanging around, like extending certain tax breaks that are already in law and are scheduled to expire. I don't think there's, right now Congress is on recess, so we don't know how that's going to play out when they come back. So I think the things that you've heard over the recess about new tax cuts probably aren't going to happen unless the economy, it looks like it is clearly headed into a recession, and then I'm sure Congress will take some actions.
So Congress has a big job ahead. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Bob Bixby, Concord Coalition's Executive Director, discuss an updated report by the Congressional Budget Office, as well as a quick update on what's going on in Washington. Thanks for joining the show once again, Bob.
Well, I'm afraid it wasn't very uplifting, but I'm
it was not our most optimistic show, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, everybody have a good afternoon and good cheer.
Enjoy the rest of the day. This is Facing
the Future. Have a nice day.
This is Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. The broken budget process should be refocused on long-term planning. The recent bipartisan budget deal agreed to by Congress is expected to add $1.7 trillion in deficits over the next 10 years. This is on top of an already dismal fiscal trajectory, with trillion-dollar deficits now expected to hit as early as the upcoming fiscal year. Both parties in Congress effectively agreed to give each other what they wanted, avoid pesky spending caps, and made no effort to set new caps for later years. In a press release, Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby said raising the 2020 and 2021 spending caps by more than $300 billion and then allowing the caps to expire is a bizarre reaction to recent projections that budget deficits will exceed $1 trillion as soon as this year. A silver lining in the deal is the suspension of the debt limit, removing it from the equation for the time being as a political weapon. Defaulting on the debt simply shouldn't be an option. And setting new top-line figures for the budget at least reduces the likelihood of another government shutdown. Of course, politics could get in the way as both the House and Senate still have a lot of work to do on appropriations bills. So what can improve the process? There's no shortage of proposals in Congress and in academia for improving the federal budget process. Given that the process has remained essentially the same since 1974, it may be well overdue for a facelift. Many of the proposals, such as biennial budgeting, could refocus lawmakers' attention on long-term thinking. Others would create long-term fiscal targets and automatic mechanisms to enforce them. These reforms could represent a positive step for the federal budget process, but ultimately, they cannot substitute for political will to make difficult decisions. The sidestepping of pay-as-you-go rules and the most recent budget deal are prime examples of this. Frankly, it's up to policymakers to set policy, and no amount of procedural changes or budget mechanisms can make them do anything they lack the political will to do on their own. But in a perfect world, or at least a reasonable one, elected leaders would abide by the defined budget process or reform it to put a more long-term lens on it. The official federal budget process was established, as I mentioned, in 1974 by the Congressional Budget and Impoundment Control Act. In practice, the process prescribed by the law has never been followed to the letter, and in recent years, it's been abandoned almost entirely. The broken budget process has either resulted in government shutdowns or policymakers applying quick fixes to avert them, instead of making strategic, long-term decisions. So what is the process that is supposed to take place? After the president has submitted his proposed budget each year, the first step for Congress is to draft and adopt what's called a concurrent budget resolution. If adopted by a majority vote in both chambers, the budget sets instructions that guide Congress in spending and taxing decisions throughout the year. The resolution establishes how much revenue needs to be raised and how much should be spent overall, but congressional committees determine how those targets will be met. This step has been the most neglected part of the budget process over the past 25 years. During that time, only 4 budget resolutions were passed on time. Congress is also supposed to enact 12 annual appropriations bills that, with the president's signature, fund what's called discretionary spending programs for both national defense and domestic areas. The House is supposed to begin passing these bills in May or June, after which the Senate considers them. Total spending levels in appropriations bills are supposed to conform to those set by the budget resolution, but in years when lawmakers have failed to pass a budget resolution on time, Congress often appropriates without operating under such a resolution, as the House has done this year. Yet no matter how Congress appropriates, it almost always fails to do so on time. Only twice in the past 25 years have all appropriations bills been completed on time, meaning both the House and Senate complete their appropriations process and agree on final legislation. And since 2009, only a single appropriations bill has been passed on time. If Congress fails to pass or the president refuses to sign all 12 bills by October 1st, when the next fiscal year starts, lawmakers have two options: let the government shut down, or pass a continuing resolution, which generally continues funding discretionary programs at the previous year's levels for a certain period of time, maybe a month or two. Congress usually passes a continuing resolution, but that does not always happen, as proven by recent government shutdowns in 2013 and in 2018. Despite taking up the lion's share of the budget process, discretionary spending actually makes up less than one-third of the federal budget. Taxes and spending on programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid are known as mandatory spending. Spending for these programs are set by formulas that require legislation to adjust. If no legislative action is taken, these programs continue operating on autopilot. Changes in such programs, as well as tax laws, can be fast-tracked through an important vehicle known as reconciliation. The reconciliation process is an optional procedure that was intended to allow Congress to consider deficit reduction legislation that brings overall tax and spending levels in line with the budget resolution. It is particularly important in the Senate, where reconciliation bills cannot be filibustered and are protected by points of order that restrict the amendments that can be offered. Unfortunately, more often than not, reconciliation has been used primarily as a tool to pass partisan legislation that fails to meet the Senate's typical 60-vote threshold. Moreover, despite the availability of reconciliation, nothing in the budget process actually requires Congress to review the current law budget outlook beyond the next 10 years, much less take corrective action. Instead, the current process, which is very long and sounds quite complicated, even if followed to the letter, encourages short-term thinking. Yet as analysts from all sides generally agree, our unsustainable fiscal path results from commitments that extend far into the future. A 5-year or 10-year budget window, which is typically the window considered now, may have been adequate back when most federal spending was appropriated annually, but it's insufficient when most of the budget consists of mandatory spending programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid set to rise in autopilot. Given both this reality and the infrequency with which the formal budget process is followed, it is time to consider some of the many options for reform and for Congress to have the will not just to enact them, but to stick to them. Policymakers can disagree about the merits of potential changes to the budget process, but one thing is not up for debate. The current process is broken, requires major reform, and leaders must have the political will to do just that, to lead. You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.